On this week's 51%, why is there so much angst among Gen X women?
And we've just had very bad luck through the years, economically, socially, and it really culminates in midlife, often in a very difficult time.
A female Army recruit talks about her choice, and we'll hear from a woman who is part of a climate music project. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. At age 43, author Ada Calhoun had achieved many of the outward marks of success and personal fulfillment. However, she still felt lousy. In her new book, Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis, Calhoun consulted with generational research and data experts and interviewed hundreds of Generation X women, defined by Calhoun as those born between 1965 and 1980, in a quest for answers. What she found was that many pervasive struggles expressed by women around her age were unique to Gen X women. By the way, there is a reference during the interview to HRT, which stands for hormone replacement therapy. Calhoun spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her new book and Gen X women.
The divorce rate was something like 4 in 10. You had almost half a chance of having a divorced family, and it wasn't like it is now. You didn't have this like conscious uncoupling or sort of sane co-parenting. Almost always, the man left, and divorced mom was left to raise the kids alone and took a really big financial hit. So women in Generation X often grew up poor, in divorced families, and then really left to fend for themselves a lot. A lot of us were latchkey kids. We worked from a very young age, and that's a big part of the middle class.
And the work environment has changed over the last 70 years. How has this impacted Gen Xers?
So, you know, our grandparents could expect to get a job and work that job for that company until they retired with the gold watch. That has never been true for us. Job instability has been on the rise. The gig economy has been on the rise. And we were raised sort of to think that if we worked hard enough, we'd be rewarded. And in midlife, we find that really is very rarely the case. Often we work extremely hard and there's no loyalty from our employers. So, you know, when our grandparents were in the workforce, there was loyalty between the employer and the employee. People could expect, and men specifically, who were the huge majority of the workforce, could expect to work for the same company their whole working life. Even a minimum wage job was enough to support a whole family. It's just very different now. There is a huge amount of job instability. It is extremely difficult to support a family without two incomes. And I think there's just a ton of anxiety because we know there's a huge amount of debt for our generation and we don't have anybody to help us out with it.
There's been stresses for generations. So how is this different for Gen Xers?
You know, what I've heard a lot whenever I've relayed the premise of the book is, oh, it's not the Depression. You know, there are no wars currently raging that are affecting this generation. And so the question I was asking with the book was really, if it is true that this is a very peaceful and prosperous time, why is there so much anxiety? I interviewed hundreds of women and just heard this fear and shame and stress. So where is it coming from? And the book is an attempt to answer that question and to just look at all the different forces at work on us, of which there are many. And we've just had very bad luck through the years, economically, socially, and it really culminates in midlife, often in a very difficult time.
I know you talk about the health stresses of Gen X women, and I was wondering if you could talk briefly about the HRT 2002 report and how that is currently affecting Gen X women.
I was so interested to hear the backstory on HRT because I grew up hearing, oh, it's really bad for you, it's really scary and dangerous, and just ignore it. And just do it the natural way. If you hit menopause, just tough it out. And in doing some research and talking to some experts, there was one in particular at Yale, this one, Mary Jane Minkin, who said that like the music stopped for menopausal women in 2002. And that was when there was a study being done that was stopped. And the way the stoppage of the study was publicized made it sound like hormones are going to kill you and just stop even thinking about them. And she said she loves estrogen, but she wouldn't have wanted to be a fish on that morning because every woman in America like flushed their HRT.
Yeah.
And basically, she was saying like that was HRT was the one thing that actually was helping women physically, and that is proven to actually help a lot of women. Not everybody can do it, but a lot of women do very well with some kind of hormonal support in this time. And so she was telling me, like, it's too bad that the one thing that was really doing some good physically just got literally flushed. So women still go through menopause usually around age 51, and perimenopause is the period leading up to that, which, depending on a lot of factors, can be a few months, it can be 13 years, and it's characterized by this fluctuation in the hormone levels that can cause, like, really wacky periods and weight gain and emotional ups and downs and a whole host of other problems, including sleeplessness. The symptoms and the time frame are the same that they've always been. Our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, we've all gone through this sort of weird time before menopause. What seems to be affecting Gen X women a lot is this anxiety and stress level, which for a lot of women of this generation is just through the roof. And there's a feedback loop. So the more stressed you are, the more you have these symptoms. The more you have these symptoms, the more stressed you are. And it can be pretty vicious. And it can involve not sleeping and things just getting worse and worse. And I heard that from so many women, that they're just full of anxiety, and then they have all these physical symptoms, and then it keeps them up at night, and then on and on.
Another topic you discuss is straddling the line between pre- and post-internet world and how social media is affecting Gen Xers. What was the consensus among the women that you interviewed?
It's funny, like, we're not native speakers, many of us, in the internet and in social media. I was surprised by how addicted Gen X is to social media. You know, one study was saying that we spend even more hours per week on things like Facebook and Twitter than millennials even, which I was shocked by, because there's this, of course, reputation that millennials are the ones who are constantly on there. You know, I think that we weren't necessarily so prepared. I think, you know, I see my kids and they grew up around it and they're so fluent. And I think that for us, there might have been a little bit of a learning curve. I think we were the first generation to hit middle age with a cell phone camera in our pocket. And I think, you know, you see that happen, and it can be, it's pretty intense. You know, you're like in high definition looking at yourself every day.
Yeah.
You know, and also then, like, with the internet, I heard one woman after another say, look how wonderful everybody else looks. And, of course, everybody else is filtered on Instagram within an inch of their lives. There is this distortion that happens. And even if we're conscious of it and know, oh, yes, this is not the real world that we're looking at online, I think that it's very hard to really internalize that and believe it, that not everybody else has it figured out.
And that goes along with this thought of your generation having unrealistic expectations?
Yeah, I think that women who grew up in the 70s and 80s were told you can be anything, even president. We were sold this idea of the American dream that had been true before. And it was not true for us. It has not been true for us. There was a statistic out of Harvard, the Equality of Opportunity Project, said that a Gen X woman has like a 1 in 4 chance of out-earning her father. So we are the first downwardly mobile generation, and I think that there's this really strong contrast between what we were told was possible, what we were told we should do and could do, and the reality of what is possible and what is feasible given all these forces on us.
So do you think rewriting the narrative comes with less of a individual adaption and more of a societal change as a whole?
It certainly would be nice if society supported women more. I think that, you know, when women went into the workforce in droves, nothing really changed to make it possible or easy to be part of a dual income household where you're also taking care of a family. And it's hard seeing all these women who I interviewed talk about how they feel like they've failed. They feel like they're doing something wrong when the deck is really stacked against them. I talked to a ton of women who chose not to have children and who made a really conscious decision and who are happy with that decision, but feel like they constantly have to justify it to people, when in fact there are a lot of really good reasons why you would choose either a career or a home and not try to do both those things at the same time. It's extremely challenging to do either one, frankly, much less both at the same time. What I heard from so many different women, no matter what choices they made, was this sense of, like, did I choose right? You know, should I have done more? And a lot of women, whether they were with families or without families, said, what did I do wrong that I either wasn't able to or couldn't or didn't want to do all the things? And it's a very reasonable decision, frankly, to not do all the things.
How has writing this book in particular helped you personally as a Gen X woman?
So writing the book really cured my midlife crisis. It really did help me first. So physically, I took a lot of the advice I got from all these experts, and it did make a difference. So there's that piece of it. I also just realized I needed a lot more support. I was trying to do everything myself. I cultivated a group of really wonderful and supportive women friends, which made a big difference. And I realized that this is a hard time, period. Like, our mothers and grandmothers often had a rough time in middle age because you're dealing with usually the illness and death of your own parents. You're dealing with a lot of things, forces hitting at once, all while you're dealing with perimenopause and menopause. There are pressures on you that are daunting. So realizing that there's a time limit and that on the other side of this, things will probably be different and may, in fact, be significantly better. So, like, personally, I got into the fall, and I felt a lot stronger, and it was a good thing because the fall has been terrible. My dad is sick. My parents' house burned down. My father-in-law died. It's all happened in the last few months, and so I'm really, like, in it with the midlife stress.
Yeah.
And so I'm really glad I wrote the book before this fall happened, I'll tell you that. You know, I hear a lot from other generations and from people in general who are not Gen X women that, oh, you're so lucky. You know, you have all these opportunities. And, you know, why are you upset? It's not so bad. And I just think that it's very patronizing. This is something that is real for a lot of women. They're having a hard time. And the question is, why are they having a hard time when, indeed, they're highly educated, when unemployment is low? And I think the answers are quite interesting and maybe say a lot about what we prioritize in our society.
That was author Ada Calhoun talking about her book, Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis. She was speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill. The Army's been trying some new methods to recruit more soldiers. A new marketing campaign called What's Your Warrior launched in November. It's short on crawling in the mud and long on high tech. Dan Boyce reports for the American Homefront Project.
Recruiting company commander Josh Trenkel has been touring brand new recruits around Fort Carson Army Base in Colorado Springs. They stopped by a shooting simulator, peeked inside military vehicles. Now Trenkel announces it's lunchtime.
Enjoying a wonderful gourmet MRE. That's a meal ready to eat.
Hey, you need water.
Soldiers hand out the brown plastic packages at random. Recruit Crystal Townsend, sitting cross-legged on the grass, she's peering into her MRE sack. She got a vegetable crumble. Townsend is 35, on the older end for a recruit.
When I was younger, when I was 18, 19, I did want to join, but I wasn't really competent myself. I didn't know anybody in the military, and I wasn't really sure I could do it.
She ended up in law enforcement, a deputy sheriff, a stable job, a professional career. Still, as she got older and closer to the maximum age for enlistment.
Looking back and having those regrets, it was just eating at me, and I finally said, you know what, I'm going to go for it.
Other recruits are just out of high school, looking for that classic Army experience as a gunner or an infantryman. I speak with one woman looking to go into communications. Another man is aiming to jumpstart his career as a firefighter. The range of ambitions these recruits have is exactly how the Army is hoping to sell itself to the next generation of service members. The new Army marketing campaign is called What's Your Warrior? And the first ad looks more like a trailer for an effects-laden superhero movie than a traditional recruitment pitch. Helicopters flying through mountain passes, a woman at a computer terminal communicates with a satellite overhead, a scientist is hard at work splitting microscopic cells.
There's this idea amongst lots of youth and perhaps even parents that there's only one way to serve, and that's in a combat role.
Brigadier General Alex Fink is the chief of Army Enterprise Marketing. He's behind What's Your Warrior? Fink says military marketing that focuses on the glory of battle just isn't working like in the past, especially as fewer and fewer Americans have family military legacies to live up to.
It's really more about surprising our audience about what you can do in the Army.
So the emphasis in What's Your Warrior is on showing the variety of career fields and the real-world benefits of service. The Army says the initial figures for this campaign have been pretty good. What's Your Warrior debuted in November, and Brigadier General Fink says the number of people filling out reply forms on GoArmy.com has jumped 35% over last year. But that's just the first step.
It's great and fine and dandy to fill out a business reply card online, but how does that translate into actually getting folks to make a commitment? So we'll see.
You guys want to fire again?
We can and that's where the individual relationship between recruit and recruiter comes in. Colorado Springs Company Commander Josh Trankel says his recruiters are using the new What's Your Warrior campaign to start the conversation.
That's where the art of it is. They really need to know how to take that message and give it to the students coming out of school these days and make sure that they know the opportunities that are available to them.
For new recruit Crystal Townsend, eating her vegetable crumble on that Fort Carson tour, the logical path would be to move from her job as a sheriff's deputy to military police. Instead, she's looking at something completely different.
My number one pick is military intelligence. I would figure it'd be a waste of opportunity to not go into something else, challenge myself by learning a completely new field.
She says the diversity of career options led her to choosing the Army over another military branch. If What's Your Warrior works, a lot more people will be taking a look at those options too. In Colorado Springs, I'm Dan Boyce.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Next, 51%'s Elizabeth Lo Judas brings us a story about a woman who has embraced music as a tool for communicating the science of climate change.
As executive producer of Climate Music Project, Fran Schulberg has a strong belief in the power of song to convey critical messages about climate change straight to a listener's heart.
Music allows people to have a very visceral understanding of the issue. It's just an emotional element that motivates people in a different way.
The Climate Music Project supports the composition of musical pieces that sonically interpret climate data in compelling ways.
By using science with the music, it has a sort of hearts and minds engagement that we think is powerful. We like to say also that we make the climate crisis personal.
Climate Music Project's mission is to communicate a sense of urgency about the climate crisis by combining climate science with the emotional power of music to drive meaningful action. Founded in San Francisco in 2014, the small organization helps to connect composers with climate scientists who help them interpret data such as global temperature and carbon dioxide levels into musical pieces that are performed live at interactive events. Schulberg works with Climate Music's executive director, Stephen Crawford, and colleague Lori Goldman to connect researchers from UC Berkeley and other universities with accomplished composers to advise them on translating climate data into song.
Our lead scientist is a renowned professor at University of Berkeley and heads the climate program at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. His name is Dr. Bill Collins. And he says, you know, he's given hundreds of lectures and nobody's ever come up to him after a lecture and said, this has had an amazing impact on my life. But after every single climate music performance, people come up to him and talk to him about how life-changing it is to hear the climate science as opposed to reading about it.
By linking composers with prominent scientists, Climate Music produces unique pieces that convey multi-layered meaning in their melodies. Since its founding, Climate Music Project has supported the production and performance of three compositions, and they're currently producing a fourth piece. We're listening to the song Climate by Eric E.M. Walker, which interprets physical and chemical manifestations of climate change.
That's a piece which covers the period from 1800 to 2250.
In this piece, individual aspects of the music represent different data indicating environmental conditions over time. Carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere sets the tempo, and temperature is keyed to pitch. Something called Earth energy balance, which is the balance between incoming energy from the sun and outgoing heat from the Earth, is audible as distortion, and ocean pH is represented by the compositional form of the song itself. As the pH in the ocean becomes more acidic, the song form degrades.
And for that piece, and for actually for all of our pieces, we look at two different scenarios in the future. The models provide information for us to use that shows what the future will be like if we continue business as usual with the current level of emissions. And the alternative scenario we chose is if countries take the actions that they've committed to under the Paris Agreement.
The power of climate music is not just in the compositions themselves, but also in their performance at interactive events intended to inspire action.
One of the things that's really important to us is that even though this is music, we're not doing it for the entertainment value. We're doing it really to motivate and to engage people into taking action. Typically, we start with a short introduction from someone on our team, generally one of our scientists, that describes the Climate Music Project, but also describes how the composition was developed, how the audience should interpret the music to understand how the data is integrated into the music. The music is then performed accompanied by visuals, which also provide context, generally including some kind of data animation in the visuals. And then the third component is audience engagement. We try to make sure that there's an opportunity for the audience to ask questions, learn more, understand what some of the solutions are. We like to have panel discussions, which include a scientist, a composer, and other experts. And as I said, whenever possible, we include representatives of local action organizations so the audience members can engage with them after the musical performance.
Connecting audiences with action organizations is a critical component of the climate music strategy.
We've created a network of what we call action partners, which are organizations which provide people pathways to do something in the short term. After coming out of one of our performances, audience members want to engage. They're motivated and they want to take that energy and find ways to meaningfully make a difference. And so we don't want to just leave them, you know, going home and feeling frustrated. So we have opportunities for them to engage with other members of the audience, to engage with our scientists, and also to talk to organizations that are action-oriented.
Coordinating a climate music event is a complex undertaking, but Fran brings unique strengths and credentials that aren't what you'd expect to find in a music producer.
Surprisingly, I'm a lawyer by training, but when I went to law school, I did so because I wanted to work on environmental policy. I've been an environmental activist since my teenage years, and when I left university trying to figure out what to do with that passion, law was the key path to making a difference.
She practiced environmental law, working with the UN and governments around the world, then headed up an international nonprofit organization before joining Climate Music Project in 2015.
I wanted to work in an area that I'm passionate about, which climate change is an area that I care deeply about. And I wanted to work with a team of people I enjoyed working with. But I also wanted to create a creative element to my work, which I really hadn't had before, working with scientists and lawyers primarily. The opportunity presented itself just at the right time, and I accepted the offer to join the Climate Music Team.
The Climate Music Team is a dynamic group of partners, including a leadership council, the Science Advisory Committee, and other collaborators like the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, individual composers, and the Action Partners. Climate Music has hosted performances across the U.S. and Europe, and increasingly in virtual performances reaching the far corners of the globe.
Were you trying to use video and other technologies to engage audiences in places where we either can't afford to send live performers or it doesn't make sense from a climate perspective to send live performers?
Looking into the future, Climate Music Project is seeking to expand its collaborations, increasing the number and diversity of its audiences and its composers around the world.
We've reached thousands and thousands of people in what we're doing now, but we're looking to reach millions. What our goal is for this year and moving forward is to engage composers from around the world that would create their own climate music that resonates with their communities and fan bases. With respect to finding composers, we're trying to make a concerted effort to get diverse composers, diverse genres of music. And we don't have country music yet or hip hop, but you know, that's in our wish list, and we hope we'll be able to do that in the near future.
Although her focus is climate music, Schulberg supports all creative efforts that confront the climate crisis.
There are many, many, many musicians who are creating music that reflect how they feel about climate change and engaging their audiences, and we really applaud this. We need all hands on deck here to really make a difference. What we really are out to do is to reach audiences might not otherwise, you know, go to lectures or talks or other ways of informing themselves about the issue in order to help them recognize the urgency of the issue and the fact that we all have a role to play in changing the trajectory of climate change.
To learn more about Fran Schulberg and the Climate Music Project, visit climatemusic.org. For 51%, I'm Elizabeth Lojudis.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1597.